You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, April 13th. Oh my gosh. Casual Friday. And Friday the 13th, I gotta be careful. Oh boy, now I'm nervous. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. Hopefully you're hearing this and we haven't had a technical snafu. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is, alas, my last day of vacation. And of course, you wouldn't have been the wiser had I not told you, because all this week, daily, every day, at least one new, fresh, great interview. Maintaining my almost superhuman streak of providing great progressive daily content. And today, make no mistake, is it the coup de grace? Maybe. Some will debate it. But it's certainly an amazing interview. I don't know. I think it's okay. Actually, I think it's really good. Thomas Frank, author of Pity the Billionaire, What's the Matter with Kansas, on his piece in the Baffler magazine on the failure of our establishment and its propensity to be rewarded for that very failure. So enjoy today's interview. If you're a member, you're also going to hear an interview I did for Ring of Fire a while back with Jason Leopold of Truth Out on the Department of Homeland Security's treasure trove of documents about Occupy Wall Street. You didn't think that the establishment would really want anybody to speak out against the failure of our elite without being monitored, did you? So sit back, listen to Thomas Frank. You should know that I may be on a plane right now. My father-in-law is taking the family down to Disneyland for the weekend. And I, right now, probably, if I am on a plane, I have begun to drink heavily, terrified that I'm going to be following my daughter around and ruining her time as she's enjoying Dopey and Pluto and Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse and Snow White, going around trying to explain to her how this Disney Corporation is just trying to sell her junk. And not just junk, but also some vision of that she should grow up and be a princess. Simply wait around for a prince. So hopefully I can refrain from doing that. I will give you a full report on my behavior on Monday, of course, because this is like ground zero for me to be completely ambivalent and conflicted. Want to see my kid have a good time, don't want to deny her something like Disneyland, and at the same time I also will be pained by how poisoned her mind is becoming. So on that happy note, let me introduce this interview that I recorded last week before I was on vacation. Thomas Frank, coming up now.
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one thing I know, the poll tax and Jim Crow and greed have got to go. You're bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose.
So on the phone is Thomas Frank. He is, of course, the author of Pity the Billionaire and What's the Matter with Kansas? And he has since revived thebaffler.com, and not a moment too soon, he has written a piece, Too Smart to Fail, which frankly is, I think, just a fantastic piece. It's disturbing, but it's also sort of, I have to tell you, your piece in some respects was what I think was one of the main, you know, what's captured in this piece was one of the sort of the main factors, I think, that drove me into political talk radio. Or I guess maybe getting tired of yelling at my TV drove me into political talk radio, but it got me yelling at my TV.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that, Sam. I really don't want to make anybody yell at their TV. I just stopped watching it, you know. I watch it strictly for, you know, to get material to write about. Like, I watched Glenn Beck sort of obsessively, you know, constantly when he was on. He was fascinating.
He was that fascinating. Sort of, but, you know, the one thing that I think your piece captures, okay, this one in particular, is that, you know, Glenn Beck is a problem, or the Glenn Becks of the world are a problem. But I think to a certain extent, they're not the problem, because
yeah, that's right.
They're a sort of maybe not a necessary, and maybe evil is a little bit too binary. But they're a sort of an unavoidable problem in society. But the real problem is that those who are the elite have not done their job. And in fact, in many ways, have been rewarded for not doing their job in keeping that impulse, the implications of those impulses, at bay.
Let me put it this way: you're getting at something that's really significant, that's really important, and that you know it bothers all of us, it annoys all of us. And so this is what I was trying to get after with this, with the essay that you're referring to. It's called Too Smart to Fail. When I wrote Pity the Billionaire, I did a ton of reading about the 1930s. And it's not just for Pity the Billionaire. I've done reading about the 1930s all my life. That's what I do. It's like it used to be my job, and it's since become my hobby. This is all I do in my spare time, that is. And one of the sort of really important things that you have to remember about the 1930s is that when they had the economic collapse last time around, it really did discredit orthodoxy, the sort of orthodoxy of the day, which was, you know, by big coincidence, the same orthodoxy that we have today, only today it defends itself differently, which we'll come to in a minute. But it was badly discredited by the collapse of 29 to 32, not just politically. I mean, politically, obviously, you had this, almost a revolution in American life, with the Democratic Party finally becoming a sort of left-wing or liberal party, which it had never been really before, and committing itself to the welfare state and to government intervention in the economy, all the things that we associate with the Roosevelt administration, to regulation, you know, social insurance, all that stuff happened. But it also, in an intellectual way, you had, an entire generation of scholars and commentators that became irrelevant, that looked like fools, and that were basically tossed aside. And you had new people come up, like John Kenneth Galbraith and Keynes in England, supplanting the old school. Now, it didn't come easily. There was a lot of back and forth. There's a lot of fighting. But it happened. This time around, it's not happening. the sort of old generation is not giving way. I mean, quite the opposite. They're more, you know, militant than ever, you know, in their own defense. And there has been no correction. You know, after a catastrophe, you have to make a correction. You have to change course. We aren't doing that this time around.
And it's not, we're not just talking about generational. I mean, we're talking about the establishment, sort of the establishment,
right?
Conventional wisdom was thrown out. And it's really the establishment that has not paid a price. I mean, you start your piece by listing off the three sort of great bubbles of consensus, you call them, the new economy, the war in Iraq, and the financial crisis, I guess, that was precipitated by the real estate bubble and all the cheap credit that was involved in that.
Yeah, but it was the reason I find it so, and I don't want to be glib about this, Sam, but here's the deal. And I'm not trying to boast. And there's always, you know, with an essay like this, there's always an element of sort of personal experience mixed in. For example, Dean Baker is a friend of mine, you know, the economist. Mm-hmm. And Dean Baker, I mean, that guy was talking about nothing except for the real estate bubble for years. No one would listen. Or you think about something like the Iraq War, where friends of mine, I lived in Chicago at the time, you know, and I didn't live in an sort of exalted, I lived in Hyde Park, yes, where the University of Chicago is located, but I wasn't an important guy. Nobody listened to me. Nobody cared about me. But my friends and I knew enough to know that, like, you know, that the Bush administration was lying and tried to sort of shoulder us into that war. And you look at the dot-com bubble of the late 90s, which, in, you know, this is what my first book was about, my first commercial book, One Market Under God, about how all of these people acted as cheerleaders for it. And, you know, frankly, I expected a correction after that. You know, I thought, you know, I used to watch CNBC all the time back then and, you know, read the sort of personal finance literature, read management literature, and the collapse of that bubble made all of these people look like fools, look really stupid. And there, you even had guys that weren't part of the financial world, like Tom Friedman, who's the New York Times foreign affairs correspondent, was one of the loudest cheerleaders for the dot-com bubble. You know, I don't know what his – why he was so involved in that, but that's, you know, that's his affair, not mine. But that should have discredited all of these people. That's what I thought at the time. These people should all be gone. But not only were they not gone, they lived to puff again. A lot of them puffed the Iraq war, same people. A lot of them came back and then, you know, blew off the real estate bubble, you know.
One of the most apocryphal, I mean, it sticks in my craw quite a bit, and people can Google it to find out why. But Thomas Friedman, in describing he himself not only was a cheerleader for that first bubble, but in justifying the Iraq war in late 2003 on Charlie Rose, he actually said, we've had these great bubbles, one that burst on the tech side and the other was the asymmetrical terrorist bubble. And that was where his famous suck on this line came from. And so he's not only repeating the same mistakes, he's using his prior mistakes as a justification for his current mistake.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? And it's, you know, and I know that people like to say, well, the internet is making all these people irrelevant, and so who cares that the deadwood never gets chopped and the fools never leave their high positions. But that's too glib also. That's not an answer, you know. And it does
and it's not
matter
true.
What
at,
the
news is. At the very least, it's not true now. I mean, I think to a large extent, I think what would happened online in 2002, 2001, 2003, 2004 with the sort of politics growing online was a function of what you're talking about here.
I think that's probably right. I mean, it's part of the same fantasy. And I mean, and look, you and I know there are plenty of really good bloggers out there. I mean, you and I probably read the same kind of things. A lot of the stuff that I talked about in this particular article that we're discussing, you know, came from or was suggested to me by one of the blogs that I read regularly called Naked Capitalism, where people often talk about the same thing. But by and large, it has not had the kind of effect generally correct. On the culture and on the politics that people think it has. I mean, do you remember what the guy that came up with that really hilarious definition of the word Santorum, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was so funny, and all my friends thought it was hilarious, and we were like, oh, that ends that guy's career. No.
Although it certainly did inhibit him, but I think you know that notion of when I think of blogs like Atrios, or when I think of Talking Points Memo, or when I think of all the blogs in sort of the sort of the Netroots world, it grew up out of a frustration of our elite and the establishment media having gotten these things wrong and cheerleading us into a war, which was clear to everybody who was not inside that bubble, was based on lies, made no logical sense. I mean, you had weapons inspectors on the ground, unable to find the weapons of mass destruction that was the reason for us to invade in the first place.
There's a term that I can't use on the radio, but basically, if you just have a healthy skepticism. Okay, at the Baffler magazine, we came out of this, like, we worked in this kind of, you know, rundown neighborhood in Chicago. We were not part of any consensus anywhere in America. You know, we weren't inside the Beltway. We didn't know any politicians. You know, that kind of thing. And we would sit around there in the office and say, "But this is ridiculous. This is crazy." You know, if you just have a healthy skepticism, you can see through these things. That's the amazing thing. You don't have to be really hooked in. You don't have to be. Now, I want to get to the second point, which I didn't really raise in the article. Why is it that, you know, that the establishment is so well defended this time? Like, why haven't we? I mean, I'm looking at the political scene right now. President Obama and the Democrats have got behind something called the Jobs Act.
Yes.
Do you know about this?
Yes.
Which basically repeals a lot of the financial regulations enacted after Enron. Okay, Enron was an example where we had a crisis and Congress took action afterwards, okay, to try to remedy that. No, I think they probably didn't go far enough, you know, just like they didn't go far enough with the Dodd-Frank bill, and not even close to far enough, as we now know, after the financial crisis this time around. But they're now repealing that, okay? They're saying, no, too onerous. They're basically giving Wall Street what they want. Now, how is it that we're, you know, headed in the wrong direction so quickly after, you know, in the aftermath? The financial crisis of 2008 isn't just an asset bubble where people lost some money. They almost wrecked the world economy. They almost threw us into Great Depression number two. That's no laughing matter, you know. And we're now headed in the opposite direction. And what fascinates me, and it's not just them, of course, but you had this, you know, whole right-wing revival in the aftermath of the financial crisis. And so when you compare this time around to what happened in the 1930s, I think it's just that consensus and establishment are, in a certain sense, are armed to the teeth. They are prepared for their own screw-ups. In the sense that they always address us as this kind of aggrieved party, you know? I like to say that they learned from their mistakes in the 1930s. You know, the orthodoxy in the 1930s came to us dressed in a tuxedo and riding in a limousine, you know, and would say, like, you, get back in line. Get back into your place. Shut your mouth. And today it doesn't say that. Today it says, oh, I'm the victim, you know. Stop it with your class warfare. That's so unfair. You know?
It's fascinating because we were so close. I mean, there was a moment where you had Alan Greenspan who, you know, it's hard to sort of point to one individual, but certainly Alan Greenspan's sort of pumping and priming of the real estate market and his lowering of interest rates as a way to sort of to both cover for things like stagnant wages, to provide for easy credit.
Yeah, but it was worse than that. He did worse things than that.
Yes, and cutting promoting the cutting of taxes and pimping the adjustable rate mortgages. And he has this coming. He has this coming to Jesus moment where he tells the Senate essentially, you know, everything that I basically based all of my economic theories on, my entire worldview, I've sort of come to realize may be wrong. And then three years later, somehow Keynes is a bad word.
Exactly. It wasn't just him. There was a professor at the University of Chicago. I think his name is Posner, and he used to be one of the sort of most militant defenders of Chicago. I went to the University of Chicago, you know, and he used to be one of the most militant defenders of Chicago free market orthodoxy. His worldview was completely shattered by the financial crisis of 08. You know, it turns out, oh, guess what? Banks can't self-regulate. You know, shareholders don't really supervise the management of these companies. Oh, big surprise. But it really was a shock to him. And he went way out on a limb, changed sides, became this Keynesian in 2008, wrote two very good books about the financial crisis, and now look what's happened. You know, he thought this was obvious. The world was changing.
Right.
You know, the orthodoxy has been smashed, and he was going to be intellectually honest and get out there and talk about it, and now everything has gone back the other way. Not because, you know, the facts have changed or anything like that. It's just because they won. It seems to have been a matter of brute political force rather than any kind of contest of ideas. And that's the okay, to sort of finish up, this is what I come to in the article. I'm watching these bubbles happen and these mistakes happen, and these sort of authoritative figures on TV and in the newspapers get things wrong again and again and again. And I'm sort of, you know, taken aback by this. But I come to it from a kind of a naive perspective where I say, well, errors like that, they're making cognitive mistakes. You know, they're thinking things wrong. They're making misjudgments. And this is the kind of thing that usually ends journalistic careers and ends political careers, you know. How do they keep going? And what I finally realized was that that's not it at all. These aren't matters of cognitive error. These are sort of moral statements. These are people demonstrating that they are part of the in-group. And that's the really, you know, frightening thing is when you realize that error doesn't have anything to do with it, with your status as a member of the sort of wise class, the class of you know of wise pundits. Getting things right is completely irrelevant. It's part of, you know, it's where you live, who you are. Are you part of the group? Has the newspaper invested in you? That sort of thing.
Right.
And also, of course, do you further their interests? You never underestimate the importance of. Look, I went to graduate school. I always thought, everybody's like me. We're all interested in ideas for the sake of ideas because we want to understand the world around us and we want to improve the world around us. We want, you know, civilization to grow better and stronger and richer. And that's not it at all. That's not it at all. That's not what ideas are about. That's not what, or I mean, that might be what they're about in the ivory tower.
But you touch on this in the piece, that something has changed. I mean, because you say that the problem goes far beyond politics, and I would agree with that. We have become a society that can't self-correct. And you go on to talk about the notion of professions. And I had a conversation with Fran Lebowitz a couple of months ago where she said the very same thing, that the real failure in our society when we talk about the elites and when we talk about the corruption, because it's not just the absence of people sort of pursuing ideas. When you say that people are part of the establishment and that they are rewarded for it and they feed into the establishment, on one point we're talking about money and status becoming an ascendant value as opposed to this notion of whether we are right or wrong when our job is to prognosticate or whether or not we are adhering to a set of norms and ethics and that our ultimate goal is to pay respect to those norms of society that was in many ways intrinsic in the idea of professions. And you mentioned what has happened to doctors. You mentioned what's happened in universities.
Yeah.
We could see it with lawyers. We can see it with every profession now corrupted.
But this is really an alarming. Yeah, this is an alarming subject that I've been sort of interested in for a long time, and I finally decided it was time to confront it directly, which is the sort of collapse of the professional ideal. Okay, which is something that you saw coming out of the 19th century, and it was one of the sort of many ways that 19th century civilization tried to deal with the free market, with, you know, this sort of this world where there were no standards and you know everything was about the money. It built up these professions with professional standards: doctors, lawyers, academics, preachers, all of these sort of things. And what you see today is that each of these preachers don't really matter anymore, but each of these has been itself in turn corrupted. I mean, if you look back over the scandals that I mentioned, say something like Iraq, where there was this corruption of the CIA that was really dramatic, or you look at something like Enron, where you had the corrupting of the accounting firm, and the accountants are one of the classic professions. They're one of the watchdogs. They're one of the people that's supposed to keep an eye on us, or on, you know, everybody else in society. And they were completely corrupted. And it's not just Enron, of course. It then turned out to be, once we started looking, it was everywhere. Or the people that recommend the stock analysts. They had their own scandal in 2002, 2003 that nobody remembers anymore. Another classic is the bond rating agencies in the real estate bubble. These people were completely corrupted. And it turned out, once we started looking, that the banks and the bond rating agencies and everybody else involved in mortgage writing and turning in mortgages into securities had managed to corrupt themselves. They'd use these incentives to sort of blow through the barriers. And once you start looking, of course it's in academia. Of course it's in the medical profession. Of course it's in the legal profession. It's everywhere you look. The rot is everywhere. I'm sorry, Sam. I'm such a ray of sunshine.
This is fascinating, and to a certain extent, you know, it's at the very least, it's important to be sort of placing the flags on the milestones as to why this, because, you know, it seems that the more I speak to people, when we talk about what has happened over the past 30 years. There is something, you know, we can, on one hand, we can explain, you know, things like income disparity. We can explain the rise of the plutocracy. We can explain this sort of failure of government and the elite to self-police and to function in a way that will not just, you know, will benefit a broader segment of society. There are all sorts of answers, you know, that started, you know, the Powell memo started us down this road. The cleavage between unions and the social emancipation movements. But there is something else that is deeper, that has affected our society in such a way that has sort of brought these forces together in some type of perfect storm. And this is one of those aspects. There is something has happened in our society where the norms, and we see this this past week with, you know, as if we didn't see it in Bush v. Gore, but there's almost sort of like you see these sort of dim little bulbs going off in sort of the establishment who have still maintained that fallacy that the Supreme Court, and I'm sensitive to this coming from sort of a family of lawyers, but that the Supreme Court may not be that institution that protected its integrity at all costs, and that this notion of professional integrity seems to have basically flown out the window, and all bets are off, and all these norms that you speak of, these ethics, these self-guiding principles that filled the gap between law and regulation and basically a feudal system, have seemed to sort of vanished. And no matter who I talk to, it's very hard to sort of get to the reasons why.
Oh, Sam, you know, it's the big M. Money.
But money's always been there. I mean, that's the thing.
I know. It's the concentration. I think it's the concentration of money. The what you find when money gets as concentrated now as it has, and this is another place where studying history has served me well, you look at the 19th century, which is basically the last time you saw money concentrated into you know, a tiny class the way it is today. It was very easy to get things done via bribery. In fact, it's, you know, there's bribery was so universal in the 19th century that, you know, why we have a regulatory state, because it was so easy to bribe judges. You know, because before you had the regulatory state, everything had to be decided, settled by lawsuit. It was too easy to bribe them. One of the reasons we have senators selected by the public rather than by state legislatures, it was too easy to bribe a state legislature. They did it all the time in the 19th century. To bribe an entire state legislature, piece of cake. When money is so concentrated, where one guy has everything at his fingertips, and so other people, you know, state legislators, are like, you know, living like ordinary people do, it's very easy to have your way with them.
That notion of the concentration of money, I mean, how did that make money such an ascendant value. I mean, where you have, doctors and lawyers and press people and journalists, essentially, they're all sort of buying in some respects.
Yeah. Well, it's both the carrot and the stick, okay? So it's both, you know, the bribery is the most naked form of corruption, you know, and of course we see all sorts of different gradations, different shadings of corruption. But then there's also the stick, and we now understand that to say things, or at least we understand, I mean, I understand now as an adult things that I didn't understand when I was a graduate student, and I thought I was interested in knowledge for the sake of knowledge and the sort of pure pursuit of knowledge. And I understand today that, you know, knowledge is the way it functions in society is it has to flatter certain classes of people. But that's also we're in a different world today than we were when you and I were growing up, and the powers that be were very, very different. For example, labor was a big player. The professions were big players. Today there's only one big player. And that is money, you know. And it's wiped everything else off the playing field. I'm sorry to be so depressing about it, but I'm talking in general terms. I know, but this is really how I see it. What I see happening to us.
And this is you know, to sort of steer it back to politics in some way, or at least in terms of the media and in terms of the establishment as we can see them. It is this rise in money as this ascendant value beyond any other form of compensation,
right,
or self-satisfaction that people would get. I'm not making a lot of money as a reporter, but I'm taking on the powers that be, and I'm doing the right thing in some sort of parallel universe.
But now we know what a fool's game that is.
Right, and we see this even in the arts. I mean, you know, there was a time where, and I think really at least throughout most of the 20th century until we get into the later parts of it, where you as an artist, you didn't necessarily have to shun money, but it wasn't a determinant factor of your value in terms
of
your
course.
Art.
Well, art has been, this is a field that has been corrupted for a long time. I mean, some fields are more corrupt than others, but you think back to the 1980s when that sort of revolution happened in the art world, where they decided that, you know, they have a traditional relationship with money, because of course that's who funds artists, right? That's who your patrons are. And so for a long time it was always about tweaking your patrons and sort of making fun of them, and then doing it in a winking way, and doing it in kind of a pretending to be like them in an ironic way, and then just being like them.
Right, but the thing is that those people, those artists at that time, had a community. Were coming from an art world that was, yes, funded by patrons, but their peers, at the very least, would give them respect, irregardless of their commercial value, and that
absolutely.
No longer exists, it seems to me.
I think that is totally right. Not only is it no longer there, but we look at that kind of earnestness. You, say the artist, the generation of the 20s and 30s, you know, who are part of what I'm talking about, that sort of revolt against orthodoxy, they had this, you know, huge contempt for, you know, for what they would have called bourgeois values or something like that. And today we look back at them and we say, "Oh, you earnest, silly people! You know, oh, you and your rosy view of the world." You know, you look at someone like Thomas Hart Benton or something like that. I mean, the artists today laugh at stuff like that. It is a big joke. The kind of social realism of the 1930s. Who's the Mexican Diego Rivera? or they red bait these guys. I'm sorry. I'm really depressing. I'm such
no,
a downer.
No.
And here I am at Disneyland.
We're
going to
have
Sam.
Happy, cheery. We've got happy, cheery interviews that are going to go all this week. So don't worry about that. But I want to get back to this because it's still fascinating to me. This notion of there is now. It's not just simply there is no accountability. It's almost the more mistakes you make in some way, the more you're embraced by the establishment. And at one point, I wrote in your piece, I wrote this is like Serpico. It's like when Serpico came back and he said, "I'm not taking the bribes," all of a sudden all the other cops were just like, "We can't trust you now."
Yes, I forgot about that. That's really good. Yeah.
We can't trust you now, because if you're not going to be one of those guys who's going to go out there and say stuff and, you know, sort of hold yourself accountable in some fashion, we can't trust you because you may hold us accountable and you're out of the club.
Yes, that's very good. That's exactly right. That's there is something really strange about it, where your mistakes are what. Perfect example is Christopher Hitchens. I used to be, before he died, you know, I was a huge fan of his back in the, when? In the 90s. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought, you know, for obvious reasons, he and I are very similar in some ways. I mean, I don't want to, his style was so great, I'll never be able to touch it. But it's sort of independent, you know, we were outside, even the sort of structures of the left, we didn't have anything to do with it. And what's funny is, he was not a celebrated or beloved figure back then. He was definitely an outsider. And, you know, I got to know him a little bit. We weren't like close friends or anything, but I was an admirer of his. You know, I went to see him speak many times in Chicago, you know, that sort of thing. And I was astonished when he became the sort of toast of Washington, which he did. You know, but when he died, there were these glowing obituaries. Everybody claimed to love him and think he was the greatest thing in the world. And what changed between back in the 1990s, you know, when you know, I and five other people in my neighborhood were his fans, to the point where he's this great national celebrity, was that he, you know, made this change. He supported the Iraq War, and not just supported it, but got more and more sort of bloodthirsty about it as it got worse and worse, and as it became more and more apparent what a disaster it was. And it was that mistake. It was that blunder that made him acceptable and made it permissible for people to love him. It's highly ironic, his fate in life.
Yeah, in some ways, it's again, it's like a sort of it provides cover for those people, because there's no one amongst us who is going to sort of hammer us with some type of moral or ethical high ground. And it was fascinating to watch. So this is the guy who basically, you know, who wrote the trials of Henry Kissinger, who, you know, was talking about, you know, and went from sort of criticizing realpolitik to embracing
participating.
Yes, and, yes, and going further in many respects, where, yeah, you know, where Henry Kissinger has to be the voice of reason. Maybe we shouldn't be invading this country for no reason. And so we have this phenomena, and then we have the failure of this lack of accountability. And very much, you know, you mentioned President Obama's deepest instincts as trust the experts. And these experts, of course, are those people in this club. And in some ways, I think President Obama is not just he doesn't just do that. He is a product of that. And in the same,
oh, yeah, that's totally right. And this is, I wasn't going to go there, but this is his larger problem. And, you know, I like Obama. He's a very intelligent man, and that's really refreshing. But what's ironically, what he represents is our sort of longing for elites who are going to fix the problems. You know, after the Bush years, where they just disaster after disaster after disaster, we want the smart people to be smart. You know, we want this guy, he's a University of Chicago professor, you know, went to Ivy League school, you know, super duper smart, articulate and all that stuff. And his instincts are all the sort of professional instincts. That's who he is. You know, he trusts professionals. That is a sort of baseline, you know, Obama's instincts. And what does he do? Of course, he turns everything over to Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, because that's when you're trusting the experts, that's who you trust. And I mean, there never were two more compromised individuals, you know. And yes, they are the tops of their profession, and they turned out to be absolutely disastrous. So it's again a sort of highly ironic state of affairs that what we really wanted was, you know, the anti-Bush, and we got it.
I think there's something to be said there, but I think in the final analysis, the similarities are when people heard change, they thought the change was going to be accountability.
Yeah.
And whatever form that took. And I think that what the lesson that has been learned on some level about Obama, and I certainly don't see any sort of real impetus for accountability coming from Romney or people like Santorum. So that's not really the issue.
Yeah,
but
a bitter chuckle escapes my lips.
But I think to a certain extent, you know, if we are to reinterpret President Obama, this is a man who I think would not have been in the position he was if there was a real sense that those who need to be held accountable were going to be held accountable by him.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the real tragedy of his presidency, is that at the end of the day, he wasn't able to be Franklin Roosevelt, you know, sweeping the old order out of the what was it that he said in his first inaugural, that beautiful phrase, you know, the high priests of our civilization have fled their positions of responsibility. Obama was never able to say something like that, and he was never able really to, because at the end of the day, that's who he is. He's a man of the professions. You know what else is really tragic, and you probably don't know about this, but in the same issue of the Baffler magazine where this my essay appears, we have a report that Jamie Galbraith, who's the son of John mm-hmm. Kenneth Galbraith, he wrote a report in the summer of 08. He got together with a bunch of other economists and wrote a report and submitted it to Obama, basically sketching out exactly what was about to happen, you know, with the financial crisis. They took no notice, didn't pay any attention. It's the most amazing thing. You know, because, but of course, you know, Galbraith is out of fashion. He's not part of the in-group. And that's a place where, I mean, we're talking about how professions get corrupted. Professional economics is, I mean, they aren't corrupt in a, like, you know, on the take sense. They're corrupt in the sense that a single way of looking at the world has captured the profession and has managed to sort of build a wall. And so if you want to be an economist,
also, you cannot buck that if you want to rise in your career. I mean,
exactly. I found that out.
Yes, you and I both. That's why we both have time to do this interview, frankly, in many respects. But this notion of and to a certain extent, I mean, I hope that there is something that is developing on the streets, and maybe we won't see it for another couple of months, and maybe it'll take even longer. But I hope that there is some alternative sort of parallel society that is creating its own sense of meritocracy in some ways, because the notion of meritocracy in this country is a joke, and maybe it's always been a joke in many respects, because, you know, that in which we determine the value of people has been set by a very sort of subjective set of norms, and people measure that. But it really is now fully just blown out of the water, where there doesn't even to be seen any adherence to the meritocracy that supposedly those who are in charge of setting those normative values are even adhering to their own set of values.
Yeah. You want to hear a sort of awful story?
Please.
Was recently reading – I was at a thrift store, and I got a copy of The Best and the Brightest. You ever read this book? It's about the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And how we got into it. And The Best and the Brightest refers to the sort of Kennedy and Johnson advisors who got us into the Vietnam War, and they were without exception. I mean, the best, say, Harvard had to offer, or you take a guy like Robert McNamara, who is this, you know, incredible genius. And it was, you know, this was his baby, the Vietnam War, or what are some of the other ones, McGeorge Bundy. You know, these guys were the top of their profession, and they couldn't see what an incredibly stupid and destructive undertaking this was. Okay, so I'm reading this book, and then I read this interview with one of the Romney advisors, and where did I see it? The interview was in New York Magazine, and they were asking this guy what they were going to do to beat Obama this fall, and he says, it's really easy. Do you remember that old book, The Best and the Brightest? We just go through it and cross out the word Vietnam and write in the economy. it's suddenly become so obvious that's what they're going to do this fall. You know, they're going to – this is the failure of the professional class. And, of course, Republicans have their own war with the professional class. It's the culture wars.
Right.
You know,
Mitt Romney
they call it the elite.
Mitt Romney's going to be a tough guy to sort of carry that banner, but
there's the weakness of the candidate himself, but yes,
it's interesting because the irony of that is that David Halberstam, his whole story, the author of The Best and the Brightest, his whole story was about usurping those reported the Alsop, one of the Alsop brothers, who was sort of carrying water for the generals, and he represented perhaps the last generation of people who were overthrowing the establishment and who were saying that the emperor has no clothes here. And it was that last generation, that last gasp of that sense of accountability in the early 70s, that we don't see that anymore. Because, I mean, you mentioned Ezra Klein in your piece, and Ezra's a very nice guy, but certainly I think one of those people who are pursuing, very nervous in many ways, it seems to me, and I I'm projecting, but his opinions are very, very careful not to hold people accountable in any sort of strident or even specific way. And you mention in your piece that he credits Michael Lewis in some respects for getting it wrong. Just explain that dynamic.
That one was so weird. I read Ezra Klein a lot, and a lot of the times I'm really glad I did read it because he's very intelligent and he's often got a scoop that nobody else has. You know, I like to read him, but his reference for. And I like Michael Lewis, too, by the way. Michael Lewis wrote a great book about the financial crisis after the fact. But before it happened, Michael Lewis wrote one of the dumbest essays about the housing bubble that anybody wrote, one of the dumbest. And Ezra Klein says, well, if it was impossible for Michael Lewis to see this coming, then it basically wasn't worthwhile to see it coming. And just think about that as a standard for measuring – you know, because there were, of course, plenty of people who did see the financial crisis coming. But think about that as a standard for measuring things. If this, you know, celebrity writer who we all like, and I do like Michael Lewis, I like him a lot, but if this celebrity writer couldn't see it coming, then it wasn't worth seeing it. If the celebrities aren't right, then it isn't worth anything to be right. I mean, it's a completely inverted standard. And yet, I think that's very typical of who we are. I don't know what possessed Ezra Klein to put something like that down on paper. Maybe it's a Freudian slip. Maybe it's the essay is Freudian slip. But whatever it is, it's very revealing. And can I just say one last thing? And I know we got to wrap this up here. But you were talking about Halberstam and that generation of the 60s and 70s overthrowing the establishment. And, of course, I was growing up at that time. And, you know, I remember Watergate. And I thought it's like – maybe it's just because I was so young then, but I thought, well, that's the end of that. You know, that old corrupt order is gone for good. We're in this new world where we've got all these, you know, bright-eyed, intelligent young people running everything who are so, you know, so clean. And, you know, another bitter chuckle. And now look what's happened. I mean, it is worse than ever.
Well, it's almost as if the lessons of those times, and certainly that was, what people sort of attributed to guys like Dick Cheney, in sort of the lesson was not so much to the broader society. It's almost as if the elite learned a better lesson, which is, you know, this
there
is the way that we do crisis management. And this is the way.
Yeah.
And, it's a. You never know who else is going to fall.
They learned their lesson better than our side did.
Yes, if one of us falls, we could all fall. So the lesson is, folks, you do not cross that code, whatever that code is.
No, but they learned from Vietnam, or from the Vietnam syndrome, more accurately, and they learned from the 30s. You know, they learned that you don't, you know, that's not how you respond to an economic crisis, you know, by dressing up in your tuxedo and yelling at everybody, you know, to obey orders. That doesn't work. You know, you want to pretend to be a protest movement. You want to be out there on the street. You want to have a guy like Glenn Beck, you know, not a guy like, you know, one of the Rockefellers or something like that.
Well, Thomas Frank, the piece is Too Smart to Fail. People can find it online at thebaffler.com, and people can check out the magazine, The Baffler. We'll have you back on when you write the rejoinder to this on how we are going to get that accountability back.
Oh yeah, yeah, I'll get right on that, Sam.
And we'll balance it out. We'll put it out as a two-piece interview. The sadder part and the happy part, but we're going to have to be satisfied with the sadder part. It's great stuff. I appreciate your coming on to talk about it.
Anytime, man.
Sitting up the pain.